Hello, and welcome to the Aluminium On Air podcast, brought to you in association with Aluminium International Today, the leading B2B magazine for the global aluminium manufacturing and processing industries. I'm Nadine Bloxham, editor of Aluminium International Today magazine and content director for the Future Aluminium Forum. Across this series of podcasts, I'll be speaking to industry experts and well-known faces about the latest technical developments, new projects, investments, and general goings-on. This week, as the International Aluminium Institute announced it has developed a resource built on a century's worth of data, I speak to Chris Bayliss, Deputy Secretary General, about how members and non-members can benefit from this, and also hear his thoughts on how the sector could learn to embrace some of the changes COVID has presented us with. Hello and welcome to Chris Bayliss from the International Aluminium Institute. Thanks for joining us today, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Nadine.
It's a pleasure. Obviously, I normally get to see your face a lot more at conferences and things by this point in the year. But
I turned my video off today for a change.
I mean, I missed you. I'd missed the face, but it's good just to be able to have a chat. And
good to speak.
Yeah, offline, we've been able to do this podcast just to kind of keep in touch with the industry. And I know you guys at the Institute have been busy over the last few months as well. I've seen a lot of new things going on, and LinkedIn has been updated with lots of nice facts and kind of keeping aluminium in check, which is good to see. So it'd just be good to speak with you and find out what's been happening.
Sure thing. Well, look, some of the LinkedIn stuff, that's, I think if you remember the aluminium story, we did it a few years ago now, but all that material has been kind of sitting there for a while. But we're kind of, I guess, taking a new, branching out a little bit and talking to the world rather than waiting for the world to come to us. So a lot of that LinkedIn output is actually drawing on that and pulling people into the IOI's work and the kind of data work we do in analytics. I guess we'll talk a bit about that later on today. But so a lot's been going on, but increasingly I think we're advocating for the metal and we're talking externally to the world, not just waiting for them to come to us.
Yeah, definitely. And that's kind of been the case, I think, especially for this industry, but just across the board while everyone's been a bit more, I say disconnected, but we've also been kind of more connected almost than normal, which has been really good. So to kind of start you off there, I know what we do is we normally have a question from our previous guest and had an interesting chat with Malt Seifert, who is the project manager for the Aluminium Expo for Reed Exhibitions Germany. Obviously, there's been a lot going on recently about them still announcing the show and a lot of other industry events have been postponed and things. So it's good to hear. We hopefully can aim towards that towards the end of the year.
Yeah, the Messer in Düsseldorf.
Yeah, exactly. Have something in the diary at least. But he actually wanted to ask a question of how are you expecting the economy to develop in the long term? And obviously this is with regards to actually the aluminium industry, but also just the economy in general.
Yeah, so look, I'm going to look a little bit longer term. I guess we at the association, our role, I guess, for the industry is to look a bit longer term and see how the industry is going to develop over those long time periods, see how the economy is going to change, society is going to change, and supply and demand of material might change. And so our view is a little bit more extended than others who are shorter term. So the interesting thing from that question is that, you know, longer term, our outlook for aluminium specifically is pretty positive. And that actually was built on a bit of work that we've done recently, actually post-COVID, to look at what, you know, long-term demand for aluminium might be. It was conducted by CM Group. It's available on our website, world-aluminium.org. And that's saying that by the middle of the century, you know, demand for aluminium could be up around 300 million tonnes. I mean, we've talked 200 million tonnes before. That's 300 million. And the reason for that is, you know, the changes were already happening pre-COVID, I guess. There was an increasing demand for green, sustainable materials going into electric vehicles, you know, electrification of energy in general, green buildings. So the demand for aluminium, I guess, was always there, changing demographics. But post-COVID, actually, the feeling is that with fiscal stimulus packages from governments and this opportunity to, you know, change the system, essentially, that's actually positive for aluminium. You know, the World Bank released a report last week, or the week before last, actually, saying that, you know, but again, by mid-century, 6 million tonnes of aluminium would be required just to fulfil renewable energy. So that's in wind farms, in photovoltaics, particularly photovoltaics. So 6 million tonnes of aluminium just in that sector by the middle of the century, as the world greens its grids, as it brings in more renewables. So actually the long-term outlook for aluminium, I would say, is pretty positive. And actually for the global economy, albeit we're in the middle of something momentous here, and I don't think just economically, I also think socially, so you can't really predict it. So long-term, quite positive. Short-term, of course, unknown, but again, opportunities to change things. And that's, you know, even being stuck at home, that's kind of how it feels, that things are changing.
No, I completely agree. I know I've spoken to a lot of kind of other companies and people during this time as well, and it's been a time where they've been able to either just reflect and get some, you know, planning for projects underway and actually take some time to focus, like you say, on the long term and what this can mean for the industry. So it's, yeah, although it's been strange and although there's been a lot of downtime and not necessarily good downtime for manufacturing, but it's we've also been able to open other kind of channels for production, especially as well. I know with aluminium, you know, the packaging, medical packaging and food packaging and everything has been in such great demand. So
absolutely. Yeah. I think that, you know, you do have to look at it segment by segment and also region by region. This is going to be a regional and segment specific shift. As you say, packaging has ridden this quite well. It's I guess it comes through in the CM Group report, actually, that the packaging folks are stable, if not some slight growth in some market segments. Severe impact, of course, on automotive, building, construction, the big uses of aluminium. But actually, one might expect those bounce backs to be strong, if not soon. So, you know, as the Chinese government starts to look at fiscal stimulus packages, I guess it's looking different from how it did in 2008, 2009. It's not about big steel infrastructure. It's about smart infrastructure. And that benefits aluminium. If it's about electric vehicles or smart grids or consumer durables, anything with a long lifetime, anything that conducts electricity, anything that has a kind of heat conductive element to it, or anything that's lightweight benefits us. So that's positive from that aspect. In Europe, I guess there was talk of the Green Deal before. Now it's about post-COVID packages incorporating green procurement, and for aluminium that's very positive too. I guess that's one of the items that came out in the CM Group report that we commissioned, is even though that demand CM Group and we see as robust to the middle of the century, it's predicated on the fact that consumers and customers and procurers of our metal increasingly demand green, responsibly sourced metal. So it's not a given that the industry will grow to meet that demand if the industry itself doesn't tackle some of the challenges around greenhouse gas emissions, waste management, etc. So yes, robust pull, but that comes with an expectation that the industry performs well.
Yeah, certainly. And also it still seems like that kind of drive towards, you know, greener aluminium and sustainability is at the top of, you know, companies and manufacturers' agenda as well, which is great, especially after, you know, these few months. So kind of leading on then to how you've been working with your members during this time and what you guys have been doing. Have you provided support, or have you needed to, you know, offer support or advice on certain market challenges to them?
Yeah, so our remit is on the kind of pre-competitive space. So so historically, it's on sustainability, health, safety, and environment. And we have a strong health committee. In fact, our health committee is one of our earliest advisory committees, goes right back to the early 70s. And historically, they've tended to focus on occupational health. Then, as time's gone by, it's much more kind of community health, I guess, environmental health. And they've been working in recent years on infectious disease, at least sharing information on infectious diseases. So a number of our members were impacted by by Ebola in West Africa and actually responded accordingly. And they were quite well prepared, I guess, for COVID with the systems in place. I think there was something through just today on Roussel in Guinea, building a medical center out there that is open to the community as well. So some of our members, a lot of our members are quite well prepared, and sharing that information between them is part of the role of the association. Having said that, I'll tell you very early on, the medical folks in the companies who were dealing with stuff on the ground, you know, right at that moment in March, they said to us, at least at the IAI, step out of the emergency room. So our role was actually to steer clear. You know, it was the companies had established those links through us or independently with each other. Lots of information was being shared. Lots of science was being shared. And actually what the doctors were saying and the industrial hygienists and the medical folks was, we need as few people in the room as possible in order to respond quickly. So part of our role was to step back, share where we could, but not to get too heavily involved. And that's a reflection of the fact that our, I guess our role is, again, it's a bit more long term. So even as COVID hit, that doesn't take away from the fact that the climate change challenge still has to be dealt with. You still have health, safety, environmental issues. You can't just stop production. And actually, that's one of the things that is coming through now for our health committee, who are working on fatigue risk management, you know, even in last year. What's happening now is that post-COVID, as companies respond with changing shift patterns, now it's a kind of a new fatigue element that's coming in. You know, you have people who are working long shifts or different shifts. Fatigue is starting to be an issue on the ground. So the kind of work we're doing on fatigue risk management, on mental health and wellness, is actually areas where we can add value to the membership. They're dealing with the stuff acutely, but that doesn't take away from the kind of long-term health and safety challenges that are always there. So I guess that's our role more to, and that's what we've been working on, is guidance around fatigue risk management. It's there's a new ISO standard 45001 on health and safety, which is incorporating some psychological health and safety, mental health work. So we're working a lot on mental health. And that, I think, is being felt by a lot of folks who are stuck at home or who are having to go to work, you know, in stressful situations during a pandemic. So actually, the mental health work, I think, is something that is going to be increasingly valuable in the future for our membership and for society at large.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. It's something actually we haven't really touched upon across any of these podcasts, but it, you know, it, like you say, it's more been geared towards the health and is everybody, you know, physically okay. But yeah, I think you're right. It's something that people have had to be, you know, just certain things have completely changed, or their like you say, their daily life has completely changed, or they've had to take on other roles of homeschooling at the same time as trying to do work. And yeah, I can imagine, you know, the stress that everyone has been under has been very different to what we're
used to. And that's a big safety implication, right? You know,
you
can have all the systems in place you like, but if someone comes to work and they've had a bad night because one of their children's ill, or they've come to work and missed breakfast, you know, a bit tired, that's the moment at which you can have potentially serious incident. Even with all the systems in place, behavior changes for a short period of time and you end up with an incident that you know you don't want to happen. So that kind of the work that we're doing on fatigue risk management is that the systems that are being built are able to cope with that to some extent, but that also employees come to work with an understanding of their limits. You know, there should be a time when an employee can turn around to their line manager or supervisor and to say, look, I don't feel I am fit for work at this point in time. You know, I've had a bad night. And I think people are doing that a bit more. It feels like that, even though we're disconnected and maybe people feel a bit more, they feel more comfortable in their own homes to do it, but to turn around to management and others, even, you know, friends and family, and to say, look, I have to look after myself a little bit.
No, definitely. It's not something that's so kind of hidden these days as well. Like you say, you do feel like you can actually say sometimes, you know, I need a bit of help, or I need some assistance with this. And especially like in an industry where, you know, it's a heavy industry, there are potential huge safety risk factors. So we have to really be on the ball. So no, I think that's really interesting. I think it's good that there's kind of a, just the knowing that those kind of programs are out there, or that kind of just knowledge is out there that will help, even if it helps just, you know, a handful of people to think, oh, actually I can say that I'm struggling, or I'm not quite as comfortable as
I would have thought I would have been working from home. I know we were just saying, you know, the changes anyway of just the office environment, for example. So, and we're both working from home, as are our colleagues and things like that. So do you think like this pandemic itself will change the way that our sector actually works when it comes to meetings or networking or developing any kind of business?
Yeah, look, I'm going to start on the shop floor, I guess, and that is going to change, has changed already. It's going to change it. Working practices are going to change. I guess you've been working quite a lot in recent years on Industry 4.0 and automation and the use of AI and things.
Yeah.
You might expect some of that to be accelerated. So that will be interesting development to see, you know, how does that interact with the human element within the industry. More broadly, yeah, look, we see each other at conferences around the world quite often, and I don't see myself traveling this year and maybe not even into next year, although I'm probably seeing more people now than ever, you know, via teleconferences and video conferences. I think the whole world is going to change, not just our sector. Meetings will change. We are a global organization with a global membership, and part of our job is to go out there and to see our members, see where they work, see their operations, meet in different bits of the world. Already we're having to change the way that we do that. And that will be a challenge for us, you know, as a truly global organization that needs to engage with all the different elements along the value chain and across the world. We're going to have to find novel ways of keeping our membership engaged and feeling that they get value from us and that we're not just stuck in London, you know, talking a European or a Western world story, really, I guess. It's going to be tough. It's going to be challenging to develop business. And actually, it's going to, you see this already, really. It's hardening up some of what was already happening pre-COVID, right? So it really feels like we're at a high point of globalization, or there was this kind of, you know, there's a return to resource nationalism and protectionism and looking inwards. And if business is done like that too, if we're not truly global and out there talking to people face to face and so on and so forth, there is a worry that you know, we look too inwards and we don't interact globally. And aluminium is a global business. You know, there's a global flow of materials, global demand with a globally priced commodity. So there's a question really about whether that kind of future is viable and even wanted by some folks too. So yeah, personally, I'm going to be working from home for the foreseeable, I guess, and won't be traveling anytime soon. But that's the reality we're all living with.
Yeah, exactly. That, like you say, that's everybody's now in the same situation, which I think it does make it easier because you don't feel in a way that you know you're missing opportunities to an extent, or you're not able to attend certain conferences or AGMs or anything like that. So everybody's on the same page.
But things are more efficient as well, right? I mean, maybe we go to these conferences and we see the same people, like me, saying the same thing on the same kind of stage with the same looking group of people, lots of white men sitting on a panel, you know, telling you the same story again and again. Lots of air miles in order to make that happen, with the possibility of some business on the margins. That's a very inefficient way of generating business.
Yeah.
And also it's a very kind of monolithic way of doing it. It doesn't, you know, if anything, this period is telling us that we need to be adaptive, able to change quickly, able to be resilient to future shocks. And if we're just telling that same old story on the same old panel with the same old faces in the same old places, that doesn't make for a very dynamic situation. So it's kind of exciting. Maybe this is the opportunity for more voices, more faces, different stories, different places from around the world. And I guess the importance there is of the platforms to do that. And that's going to be a challenge, I think, for folks who do conference organizing. I mean, you've done your conferences too, your workshops. So that's a challenge to be able to maintain that business. I guess these podcasts are a response to that to some extent.
Yeah, I miss talking to people. That's why I had to set this up. I need to have a conversation. I'm being a journalist at heart, I can't not just talk.
And conversations is maybe the way forward, because you know what we saw before with conferences and things is one way flow. and you know, there's not much opportunity to have some really sometimes difficult, challenging conversations. So
that's it. Unless you're going there to, you know, specifically meet people, or I know that some of them are obviously more aimed at real technical innovations, or like we'd said, you know, the industry four side of things, and actually looking at how an industry can develop on that sense. But some of the, you know, some of the conversations that I had are more of just the market outlooks, and like say the certain same old conversations that I had. This definitely gives us more of an opportunity to actually say, right, you know, going on from this, we need to really move forward and not get as stuck maybe as we might have been. But great opportunity, I think. So, and one of my other questions was going to, which I feel like we've already touched on, was just, you know, what in a good way, but what do you think the kind of big global and maybe more regional issues would be?
So like I say, that is, it does feel like this is crystallized what was already happening to some extent. I mean, it's very interesting. This, you know, I always tell this story that, you know, we as the II were incorporated in 1972 on the back of the energy crisis, at the beginnings of the globalization of the aluminium industry, right? The LME aluminium contract comes a few years later with the global price discovery. And now we're all having to adapt to something that feels a bit different from 1972. It's this kind of, it's not a disintegration of globalization, but there's certainly a change happening. And so post-COVID, what is going to be interesting is on the one hand, seeing whether that kind of breakdown is challenged and whether there is this kind of global response. To some extent, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like what was already happening in terms of trade wars, resource nationalism, is becoming hardened by this, but we'll see. On the other hand, that is that government response, and that will be interesting, because up to now, you know, when we've talked about market development, companies, some of the, in recent years, the automotive has been the big push. So it's been companies talking to OEMs, developing specific alloys for those end uses, and to some extent, certainly among our membership, a bit of a move upstream. So our membership is much more primary focused, I guess, than it once was, where you had integrated companies. But that move towards demand for aluminium has come from OEMs, big customers, quite vocal customers, sometimes demanding green aluminium. But as we move forward and countries and regions start to rebuild or to build anew, it's going to be government procurement or public procurement that could drive some of these big changes. And so let's say you start to accelerate electrification of vehicle fleets in China. Well, then it's the Chinese government or provincial governments or even municipalities you need to start to talk to about generating demand for aluminium and other materials. And as I said right at the beginning, that could be positive for us, but it's a new way of talking to these kind of customer groups. We've seen it in recent years, I guess in Canada, in Quebec anyway, that there was a big push, and I think you've talked about this before, about these aluminium clusters where you have a very strong primary industry, lots of support from the local communities, but also an opportunity to export the energy that you're using to produce the aluminium, you know, elsewhere. So you have to make a case that you're using the energy for the benefit of Quebec to produce a material that is then generating jobs downstream. And so the guys at, in Canada have done a good job of building these clusters where they talk to provincial governments or they talk to municipalities, those who are doing the procurement, about total cost of ownership, the full life cycle benefits of aluminium, about that keeping the value of the energy and the metal going in the Quebec economy. So you might start to see some of those things developing elsewhere in the world. I'm sure you will. And that's kind of exciting too. Big global issues. Climate change doesn't go away. In fact, the challenge is increased. Certainly people are much more aware and much more vocal in their demand for low carbon materials. And the other is security of supply of raw materials. So if we have a 200 million ton demand for aluminium by mid-century, it's about 100 million tons of primary. That means 500 million, half a billion tons of bauxite required every year.
Wow.
and And you've got to think, where's that going to come from?
Yeah.
And you know, in recent years, Guinea has emerged as a big exporter of bauxite. Guinea, of course, has its own challenges. If you have like one supplier as well, that can be a risk. So I think security of supply of materials, both bauxite, but also scrap, quality scrap. They're my big ones, I guess. Climate change and security of supply. They're global issues, but they're felt regionally. Right,
yeah.
So
yeah.
You know that the investment in Guinea has, in particular, come from China to get hold of that raw material. So you're going to see this kind of global regional interplay. And our job as the Global Association, I guess, doesn't get any easier in that situation, because back in 1972, we could tell a global aluminium story with a membership that all kind of looked the same kind of technology, same kind of places, same demographics, same energy sources. You know, they're kind of all at the same, they were just in different bits of the world, all integrated. And now our membership is very diverse, with different carbon footprints and different operations and different ages of industrial capacity, different demographics, different health and safety challenges. So responding to that, it has to be more nuanced, it has to be more dynamic, has to be more responsive. It can't just be a boilerplate global response.
Yeah, definitely. And there we go. See, working from home, but we've, workloads have doubled, and if not tripled, there's even more going on, and yeah, more to kind of keep up with. And this has been something that, again, I've spoken about a lot on this podcast and just in general in the magazine, that the looking at the state of supply, because, you know, the primary industry needs to be modernization across some of it as well. And that's why we're looking at this industry for and making cleaner and kind of greener aluminium, but then also, mm-hmm. bringing this idea of, you know, a closed loop, so we can make the most of the aluminium that's already in play. This is, and again, this is all stuff, like you said, we've kind of hit on at certain conferences, and just everybody knows what we need to be doing, but yeah. it's just kind of getting there, really, but hopefully this will be
although you know what we've seen in recent years, again, it comes back to this moving away from this integrated picture, is that different folks operating at different points in the value chain don't necessarily understand that interconnected nature. And always the recycling element, or at least the post-consumer, the refiners, are a completely different beast to the rest of the industry, the primary guys, and to some extent the remelters. You know, what they do is a bit of magic, it's kind of alchemy. And they tend to be small companies, and they tend to be very opaque. They're less able to engage with a kind of a bigger picture. And so the primary guys would say, well, you know, the recycling is important, but then the primary guys aren't involved in recycling. And actually the main issue, I think, other than collection, and we can talk a bit about what segments that needs to happen in, it is about sorting and separation. And there it's about design, right? We've heard this before. I don't know if you've talked to the auto guys on these podcasts, but that has been the big thing, you know, in recent years, is about joining technologies that to some extent contaminate that clean alloy supply that could be there at end of life. So designing and constructing products in a way that they can be separated easily at end of life is important. And there, that's not the primary industry. The primary industry is about three steps removed from that. That's the OEM. So all these folks along the value chain need to be brought together to come up with those kind of solutions. That's part of our role as an industry association, is to do that, to join these elements up. But I have to say, in recent years, they've become less joined. It's just a function of the change of the industry.
Yeah, and like you say, it kind of comes down to, as well, knowledge and understanding other areas of the value chain that they might be aware of, but not necessarily, you know, put two and two together as to exactly how their technologies or their products really work further on.
And their ability to affect change.
Yeah.
Right, you can know it as much as you like, but do you have the power to do anything about it?
Yeah.
And that, to be honest, that's the big question around the primary side now. For all of the technological changes that will impact direct emissions, you know, the biggest source of us globally is the indirect emissions from electricity supply. Many of the facilities have captive power and stranded power as well, and they tend to be fossil fueled. So if you're based in west of China with coal, your options are kind of limited. Your ability to change is limited, especially with a new facility, you know, one that's been built to last for 40 years,
yeah.
And your options are close down and build it somewhere else. That's not much of an option.
Yeah, no, certainly. Well, and like we say, if anything's going to come out of all this, then change is definitely something we need to be looking at. What kind of change?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. But I could talk to you all day about this kind of stuff. But one thing you did mention was obviously you must have procured so much data since 1972, and I know you recently announced this global aluminium cycle, which I'm sure people will have seen the announcement on, which is a resource built on a century of aluminium industry data. So just before you kind of disappear, what is this and what does it mean for the aluminium industry?
So the first thing is, don't get scared by a century of the data. So the whole point of this is, the whole point of this is to package that up in something that's easily digestible. And you may have seen before that, I mean, we've been working on what are called material flow analyses for almost 20 years. My colleague Marlene Bertram is expert within the II Secretariat, and we've been looking at the flow of materials all the way through the value chain to understand, well, historically we wanted to understand, where is scrap going to be generated in the world, at what point in time, and in what form is it going to be? And that allows you to say something about how much primary you would need in the future to meet demand over and above that scrap supply. Also says something about the quality of the scrap and the kind of segments and applications you could use it in. So let's say in the future you say, well, there's going to be lots of electric vehicles, they're going to use lots of raw aluminium in body sheet, but actually your supply of scrap in 2030 is mainly going to be engine blocks and some building scrap. Well, what does that mean for the supply of material into the automotive segment? So we've been working on that for about 20 years, quite a mature model, and we've had a number of visualizations built around that to kind of that people can then use to talk to customers or policymakers or even or academics or others about the future of the aluminium industry. It's quite rare, really, in commodities to get that view. You get sometimes some analyst views on what's going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years. You get some kind of futurologist views of what's going to happen in the next 50 to 100 years that are very vague. What we have here is a tool that enables us, me, to come on here today and say, actually, we're going to need 200 to 300 million tonnes of aluminium by mid-century, and 100 to 200 million tonnes of that is going to need to be primary, and that the scrap flow is going to be made up of X, Y, and Z. So what this flow, what this website does is it delivers all that historic data, where the aluminium's come from, where the bauxite is mined, how that flows through the global system, so where that bauxite goes to be refined into alumina, how that alumina goes into primary aluminium, and then it looks at how much of that material finds its way into use, so in long life buildings or in automotives, and how much is coming back in the loop. Historically, it does that from 1960 up to the present. And then we have some scenarios out to 2040, looking at, well, what might the future look like under various scenarios, some of which are post-COVID. So we have a kind of a pre-designed post-COVID scenario that says quick bounce back, one that's less quick as well. That's for the public. So you can go onto the website alucycle.world-aluminium.org and find that material publicly. And then we have a members only area, which actually breaks that data down even further into forms. So flat roll products, profiles, castings, and regionalizes the forward-looking data as well. So what the website is built on thousands of data points, if not tens of thousands of data points, including UN trade data. You don't see that though, you only see the kind of front-end visualization, which is designed for use in presentations and things. There's two parts to it. One is the actual global flow regionalized. The other is a kind of a regionally specific piece where you could say, well, what's coming into Europe? What happens to the material when it's in Europe, and how much does Europe export? And they're quite interesting data in this discussion around resource nationalism or protectionism or this change in the global flow. So you as a region can sit down and say, well, actually, if we're exporting, you know, if we as Europe want to limit, and I'm bringing up Europe as an example here, but there's lots of examples from around the world. If we as Europe say, actually, we don't want to export our mixed scrap to the rest of the world, we want to keep that scrap in Europe. Well, that's a decision that you might think that we might make, but the quality of that scrap then limits your ability to do anything with it. So if we want a future that is delivering wrought alloys to the electric vehicle market, well, we're going to need a lot more clean scrap, we're going to need well-sorted scrap, and we're going to need lots of primary as well. So from a regional perspective, you can begin to pick apart this kind of future flow of materials and whether it's going to meet the kind of demand these regions require. So there's lots of visualizations, lots of nice pictures. And also we're working on a data download option, because I know that lots of analysts use our information. Any analysts out there using our information, it would be great to get great if you could reference the IRI.
Yeah.
we're going to be putting a data download function in there as well, so people can actually pull the data and do the maths themselves. And that's a bit of how we at the IRI have operated historically, is we tell the story. We say, look, these are our scenarios, but we're very open with the data. We want you to go in, you analysts, policymakers, academics, customers, interrogate that data, whether it's life cycle data or material flow data. Tell us when we're wrong. Tell us when you have a difference of opinion, but use that very transparent, very open data set, in a scientific way. So that solid science basis, data driven, is kind of what we're all about, and yeah, makes us unique really among commodity associations, commodity groups. And it has allowed us to build up this big database. As I say, as you said, a century's worth of data is in there from the very beginnings of the aluminium sector back in the late 19th century. What is interesting though is that even with that long history of data, really our industry's story is, that's quite short, only 100 years, 120 years. Really, the story of demand is the story of the last 20 years. So yeah. We talk about, I forget what the numbers are. It's something like 1.1 billion tons of aluminium have ever been produced, and 750 million tons, we've talked before, are still in productive use. So 75% is still in productive use.
I always remember the 75% bit, but
it's about 800, I think, in use, 1.1 billion ever produced. But I think it's something like 700 or 800 million it has been produced in the last 20 years. So the majority of that stuff that is out there in use is actually a product of very recent history. So that 75% is as much a function of the fact that aluminium products are durable, they last a long time, in buildings or in automotives, as it is about recycling. So it's a long-term data source, but actually what has really made the biggest impact is the last 20 years. So that we talked earlier on about short-term change, that's a significant short-term shift for the aluminium sector in terms of both supply and demand. And it's that kind of story that I see continuing out until the middle of this century.
Yeah, and like you said, really interesting to see that, now we have had all that short-term change, how it will continue, because obviously everything is moving a lot quicker these days, the technology and this automation and robotization within actual manufacturing will only kind of aid that, I imagine, and aid how quickly everything is coming on.
And that will be an interesting, as I know we're probably running out of time, but this is interesting, is that with this deintegration of the aluminium sector, and among our membership, what we also see is then the various points in the chain in different parts of the world. I mean, that's a function of the high point of globalization. But what it would be interesting now is if you start to see some of that being reintegrated, with these aluminium hubs or some of the technology parks, particularly in China. I think the aluminium valleys in Siberia do this too, where you see some of these processes reintegrated, and maybe you lose some of the remelting steps, and where automation can make that more efficient. So that will be interesting to see if that is the path that is followed, at least by some in the industry, to kind of reintegrate all of these steps.
Yeah, no, different. And I'm glad you've given it a little plug, but I'll make sure to obviously put all the links up on our website and
thank you
after this podcast as well. So no, it's only fair. And there's been no bribery here, but I have already, which I've not done for anybody else, but I've let you into a little secret of who my next guest is for the next podcast. So I didn't know if you'd sort of tailored a question to them, or if it's still quite a general question.
It's a general question, but okay. but it is also.
I didn't have to let the cat out of the bag then.
But now I know who it is. I do have a more pointed question for them, I guess. And actually, I was on a CRU webinar last week with Al Vance. So. My question is related to that, and you may have seen my the arguments I was putting forward on that webinar. But I'm interested, as LME launches this trading platform for low carbon aluminium that allows producers and customers to, I guess, to be transparent about their carbon footprints that they have and the customers, the ones that they demand, and then to build trades accordingly. I'm actually interested in whether producers are changing the way that they operate on the back of that. And actually, for more broadly, I'd be interested in whether customers are changing their procurement patterns based on that, whether they see that the launching of these green or low carbon trading platforms actually change the way they do business. So,
good question. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Well, I will, I'll fire that one over at the next guest. And I can imagine that'd be quite an interesting way to begin the next podcast.
Sure thing.
Oh, thank you, Chris. As always, it has been a pleasure to speak with you. And like I say, we'll make sure all of the information about, especially the global aluminium cycle and any other projects that IAI are working on at the moment are kind of up on our website and available for any listeners as well.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for having me, Nadine.
Yeah, hopefully
good luck with the rest of the podcast.
I'll hopefully see you soon at some point, maybe this year.
Fingers crossed in Düsseldorf, but we're holding my breath.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks again. Cheers.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Aluminium On Air podcast. If you'd like to know any more about the global aluminium cycle from the International Aluminium Institute, please visit www.alucycle.world-aluminium.org.